This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We have our panel of trumpet writers eager and ready to discuss the very important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Good morning.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And in our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
These are extraordinary times we're living in. We're only 2 weeks into the Donald Trump administration. We're already seeing some amazing developments happening in theaters around the world. The pace has noticeably picked up in the fulfillment of end-time biblical prophecy. And we at the Trumpet, well, we're kicking our operations into a higher gear in order to keep pace. If you visited thetrumpet.com at all this week, you will have immediately noticed the fruits of our efforts. We have a significant increase in the number of articles that we've posted there, a lot of really good stuff that has gone up on the website this past week. And we're going to start with one of those articles. It was called Eastern Europe Trembles as Russia Marches in Ukraine. There's been a lot of concern about how Russia would respond to a Trump administration, possibly giving it a freer hand to act in the world. And it seems like those concerns started to be confirmed this past week. Last Sunday, combined Russian separatist forces used artillery and tanks and rockets to attack Ukrainian forces in eastern Ukraine. This has a lot of people, particularly in Eastern Europe, panicking. And for this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
That's right. So there was some quite significant artillery fire over the weekend, some of the biggest fighting that we've seen, well, definitely the biggest fighting we've seen in the Ukraine in Ukraine in several months. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe reported 2,260 violations of the ceasefire, which I think is a good sign that the ceasefire is
obliterated.
Not holding. Yeah, it kind of gives this comical image of somebody sitting there with a clipboard and a tally sheet counting the missiles as they whip overhead. Mm. But definitely things are breaking down. And now it looks like the Russian-backed forces, they're advancing on Avdiivka. It's a town kind of near the border. I think it's fairly close to Donetsk. And this is there's some fairly significant industrial plant there, a coking plant that's important for Ukraine. But there's also around 20,000 people there that are now without heat or water and electricity, I believe, as well, in a winter where temperatures are down to 0 Fahrenheit. It's the kind of the harsh Ukrainian winter. So a significant assault there, and people are talking about the potential of a humanitarian crisis in Avdiivka, and definitely a big escalation from what we've seen in recent months. I mean, really, the Ukraine crisis and the Ukraine conflict there, it didn't go away after 2014. It went out of the news, but there's still been a lot of fighting going on. But this is a level up from what we've seen for a while.
So let's put this into context for us, Richard. We're just right into the Trump administration, and this is kind of what a lot of people were really concerned about, that Russia would feel like they would have a freer hand to do what they wanted to do. Is that what we're seeing here? And how does Ukraine respond? How does Eastern Europe respond?
Yes, exactly right. This comes just a couple of weeks now into Donald Trump's presidency. It comes very shortly after Mr. Trump had a phone conversation with Mr. Putin. So just that timing there is very significant. And of course, because this is such a big deal, people have been really watching very closely to see how Mr. Trump responds. This is the first real test now. We've had months of speculation of what he's going to do on Europe. So every statement he makes is just being scrutinized. But people are already starting to get concerned about what appears to be a lack of response from Washington. So, for example, the White House spokesman, Sean Spicer, he didn't have anything to say really about it when he was questioned. He just said that the president was being kept aware of developments. People also noticed that the official American statement that was put out condemned the violence in Ukraine, but did not mention Russia at all. Which is a significant change compared to some of the memos and things that were being put out by the previous administration. So, I mean, that's a bit reading the tea leaves there. It's still early days yet, but this is kind of – everybody's looking at this now saying, okay, well, are we going to see an America that stands up to Russia, or are we in a time now where Vladimir Putin can do whatever he wants and America's not going to do everything? I don't think we can conclusively say the answer yet, but a lot of people are looking at that and saying, well, so far it doesn't look like Donald Trump's administration is going to respond in any way whatsoever.
Very significant development here. And just to kind of turn our attention to the way that you reported on this on thetrumpet.com mm-hmm. in your article, you were really focused on the response among Lithuania and some of these Eastern European countries as they're watching this unfold and they're asking themselves, how much are we actually going to be able to count on America to defend us? This really puts them in a pickle.
It does. I mean, some of these Baltic countries don't even have any jet airplanes in their air force. They cannot hold their own against Russia. They're completely dependent upon NATO, upon America for their defense. And so you can see that there's just the prospect that America won't defend them puts them in a real panic. And in the Trumpet, we have some quotes from an article called on the Trumpet Weekly, "In the Baltics, Waiting for History to Start Up Again." And I just thought it had some stunning illustrations of just the climate of fear that is building in this region. And Andrew Miller has an article in the Trumpet that the latest Trumpet that talks about some of this as well. But it talks about, you know, how just people are buying boats so that they can escape via the Baltic if Russia invades. And that's becoming something that's fairly commonplace. You know, we've got to have our backup plan for when Russia invades. People storing gasoline so that they can flee the country at the last minute if necessary. And then you look at, well, where is this leading Europe? Well, you know, Ukraine was understandably quite rattled by Donald Trump and some of his statements. They were rattled by him having a phone call to Europe, to Vladimir Putin. So where did they go straight away? They went to Germany, and that's exactly mm-hmm. where the Ukrainian leader Petro Poroshenko was when the violence started escalating in Ukraine, and he flew back from Germany. Now, Germany still got a long, long way to go if it's going to be able to replace the United States in there. You know, as part of this article, I included some data that came from a graph that Geopolitical Futures put together, and the graph is very stark because you see how much the United States spends on its military minus pension costs, and it's huge. And then every European country is pretty minimal compared to that. You know, every European country combined doesn't even come to half the non-pension spending that United States has. So for nations in Eastern Europe to feel as comfortable, say, with Germany at their back as they do with America, that needs some big changes. But you are starting to see this sense of urgency in Europe and within Germany. And this article also has a quote from the former German foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, where, just to paraphrase, he basically said, oh, here's the quote. Yeah, thrift is undoubtedly a virtue, but other considerations should take priority when one's house is on fire and about to collapse. And that's the start of thinking that is building with Donald Trump's presidency, with just so many things that Europe had taken for granted changing. And, you know, they're starting to feel, okay, well, the house is on fire, things are about to collapse. We need to, you know, break out of our old patterns of thinking and make some major changes.
This is not a story that's going to go away anytime soon. We'll definitely have to be following this. And while we're on the subject of Russia, a report this week showed that Russia's military presence around the Arctic, it has grown to levels that haven't been seen since the collapse of the Soviet Union. A lot of people say Moscow is actually going to achieve greater capability, more control over this strategic and resource-rich region than the Soviets ever had. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, Russia actually claims about 500,000 square miles of the Arctic, and a lot of that area is also claimed by other Arctic coastal states, Canada, Norway, Denmark, and the United States all have claims. But Russia really seems to be the only one of these claimants that's taking steps to be able to enforce its claims. In the last few years, the Russians have established 4 new Arctic Brigade command teams. They've built 16 deep water ports, a new Arctic command, and 14 operational airfields. They're also building 6 major military bases. Some of these are refurbished old bases that had sort of fallen into disrepair after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and some of them are being built from scratch. And then the Russians are also expanding their fleet of icebreakers. These are the special purpose boats that can break through ice and just clear channels for other watercraft to be able to navigate through. The Russian military has about 40 of these already, several of which are nuclear powered and very formidable, and they're right now building about a dozen more. And so the icebreaker fleet is especially significant, I think, because Russia is the only nation that possesses one of these fleets. It lets them access parts of the Arctic that no other country can get ships to. And it may be kind of easy to say, you know, so what? Who cares about a bunch of barren, frozen wasteland and frozen ocean? But the Arctic is incredibly resource-rich. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that it holds oil and gas reserves equivalent to about 412 billion barrels of oil. That comes to about 22% of the world's total undiscovered oil and gas. So it's really substantial there. That makes the region extremely valuable. And with all of these icebreakers, Russia is able to make, you know, basically super highways through all of that ice to position itself to start tapping into some of these resources. And then there's also great strategic value in the region. Right now, there are already missile defense systems installed around there, and control of that airspace would allow planes to overfly the North Pole to quickly reach destinations across the Northern Hemisphere. It would also give multiple entry points into international waters to the Russian Navy. So it would really give a military global mobility, at least in the Northern Hemisphere there. So for all of these reasons, a lot of analysts believe that the Arctic is of far greater value and importance than the U.S. has made it out to be. And there's a lot of concern right now about just how the world is sort of quietly looking on while the Russian military essentially takes over this vast area.
Well, it's interesting to watch what Russia is doing here in light of its behavior in Ukraine and some of these other areas. It definitely is on an expansionistic track, and you'd have to expect that unless somebody forcibly stops them, it's going to continue in an area like this. As they continue to accumulate these resources, it just increases their capacity to make further expansion.
That's right. Yeah, it looks on like they're really on the march, and I don't know who would try to curtail that, at least in the Arctic right now.
In our Trumpet Weekly, we have an article here about this, Russia's military push into the Arctic approaching Soviet-era levels. The Trumpet Weekly is this report we produce every week where we try to cultivate the best material that we can from the news all over the world from the previous week. There's a quotation in here from the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, an article he wrote back in October 2008 talking about the implications of Russia's military rise. What we see happening in Ukraine, what we see happening in the Arctic, really does back up what he talked about in this article called Russia's Attack Signals Dangerous New Era. Definitely something that we need to continue to keep our eyes on. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Right after Donald Trump was elected, he made a phone call to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and we talked about this on the program last week. Prime Minister Netanyahu immediately announced Israel would start building settlements in the West Bank again. This was in direct defiance of the recent UN Security Council resolution that says that construction is illegal. Well, this week, Mr. Netanyahu had, maybe you could say, a couple of setbacks to this policy of pressing forward with construction. To learn about these, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So there was this case of a small outpost that was illegally constructed inside the West Bank, the Amona outpost. You could call it a really small settlement that has been going back and forth through the Israeli courts over the past year. It's been a really big story in Israel because it was built illegally and the government wanted to keep it. But then the Supreme Court told them, no, you have to dismantle that settlement. So this week we had a dismantling of an outpost, the Amona outpost in the West Bank, where Israelis were removed from the houses that they've been living in for 20 plus years. So to compensate for that, Prime Minister Netanyahu wanted to show that he was still very much for building inside the West Bank, though in this case, the Supreme Court said that they couldn't live in this part of the West Bank. So he said that he is going to construct a new settlement on state land inside the West Bank in the very near future, which upset many people in the world that he would be so bold as to say, we're not just going to expand the current settlements, as in there's a settlement or a village somewhere in the West Bank, and natural growth needs would say that you expand that settlement so that if you had a baby or something like that, you need to expand. He was saying that we are going to establish new settlements completely on entirely new bits of land. Most of, I'd say 98-99% of what we've seen about Israel OK's building permits in the West Bank, they're just expansion of all territory that Israel is already living in. So it's not that much of a big deal. But that, the case that he is now looking to expand in settlement locations in the West Bank, did get the ire of the world.
And among those who expressed disapproval, we had some kind of rumblings out of the White House about this.
Yeah, this actually was kind of surprising. It came today with the press secretary, Mr. Sean Spicer. He said this. He said, while we don't believe the existence of settlements is an impediment to peace, the construction of new settlements or the expansion of existing settlements beyond their current borders may not be helpful. So this is the first time that we've seen anything negative from the White House directly towards Prime Minister Netanyahu. Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's okayed up to 6,000 new building permits in the past 2.5 weeks. A huge jump. I mean, this is something that hasn't happened for, I can't remember when was the last time there was such an expansion so fast. What I think it was the fact that over the past couple of years, he has been very limited in giving these building permits because he was worried about what the President Obama would do. So they've been building up. So basically, you got a backlog at the settlement office, and they said, okay, we're just going to okay the ones we have. And yet the United States now is saying that what you're doing, Israel, might not be helpful towards a future peace.
Yeah, what do you suppose Mr. Netanyahu's motivation was here? Is he testing the limits of how much the United States is going to have his back in making this kind of a proclamation?
I think it's a bit of both. With a bit of that, just seeing how much, whether they're going to be all for me or whether there is a limit to how much they're going to give me a rubber stamp on anything I want to do. Mr. Trump has talked about that he does want a peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and this is making it harder, I think. It shouldn't necessarily, because the Palestinians are generally the impediment to peace in their non-recognition of Israel right next door. But nevertheless, he says, Mr. Trump believes that if you keep on building these things, you're going to make it more difficult for me personally. This is now going to reflect on Trump if he cannot get a peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But you also have to think about Prime Minister Netanyahu being the leader of Israel. And there is a lot of the population of Israel that believes it's Israel's right to build inside the West Bank. And he also has to ensure that the Israeli right doesn't shift out of support for him and go to further right-wing parties. And there are a number of further right-wing parties inside the Israeli Knesset. So he's got to worry about both of those factors, and it is a very tight rope to walk on.
Thank you for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We have one more story before the break. This week, President Trump announced his choice for the next Supreme Court justice to replace the late Antonin Scalia. Well, just like everything else with Donald Trump, the choice was very polarizing. Some said it was a home run. Others said that it heralded the end of human civilization, pretty much. And for this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, as 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time this past Tuesday, President Donald Trump announced Neil Gorsuch as the next, as his nominee for Supreme Court Justice, of course, pending Senate confirmation. Judge Gorsuch hails from Colorado and has served on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And somewhat surprisingly, is one of the few constitutional originalists left in America. That's getting few and far between to find someone who upholds that legal philosophy anymore. But as a textualist and an originalist, his philosophy for interpreting the law is that you should interpret the law as it is written or as the people who actually wrote it intended. In regards to the Constitution, that would be how the Founding Fathers intended it to be implemented. And then in regards to other legal statutes, it would be just whatever reasonable person at the time the law was written would have understood it to mean. That's what it means, which is definitely...
It shouldn't be that radical for a judge to think that way. That's essentially Antonin Scalia's point of view. And so Gorsuch would essentially be... filling that slot with similar type of judicial ideology.
Right. So it definitely, or at least it looks like it's going to basically just restore the status quo to the Supreme Court as it existed 12 months ago. 12 months ago, you'd had four more or less conservative justices who believed that they should interpret the law as the lawmakers intended it to be interpreted. You had four progressive justices who believed in more of the living constitution, that believed that you should be able to interpret your own opinions into the law based on what the circumstances of the time are. And then there's Anthony Kennedy, which is basically just a magic eight ball. I'm not sure how anyone interprets normally how he rules, but he's normally the swing vote. About 50% of the time he rules with the originalist, and then the other 50% of the time he rules with the living constitutionalist.
So, in other words, if Gorsuch is confirmed, essentially we'll have the same status quo on the court that we had, the same court that ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, in favor of Obamacare. The idea that a Gorsuch nomination is going to be this radical transformative presence on the court really isn't founded in reality.
Right. I mean, I guess the main positive of a Gorsuch nomination is that if you would have appointed another progressive justice, then there would have been five progressive justices.
Right.
And then one moderate and three conservatives. So the court would have been transformed into basically a new legislative body that can make up new laws as it goes along.
Right.
The fact that they've appointed Gorsuch as an originalist restores the status quo to what it was before. But like you said, even with Antonin Scalia, as principled of a judge as he was mostly famous for his... dissents. He dissented on the homosexual marriage ruling, and they did it anyway. He dissented on the many abortion rulings. They did that anyway. Dissented on Obamacare. They did that anyway. So this appointment definitely stops the progressive living constitutionalist theory from just dominating the court, but it also basically just restores the status quo to what it was 12 months ago when the constitutional originalists were still losing out on most of the major cases.
Yeah, what's interesting about this, I guess, is what happens next. Who the next justice is? Because if Kennedy, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg, if she descended from the bench, then and he replaced that individual with another one, say along the same lines as Gorsuch, then you could have pretty significant transformation. I guess that would be the cause for optimism among those who really support the choice of Gorsuch, and maybe that's what's causing those who want the living constitution to have such conniptions over this.
Right, because they say if President Trump ends up as a two-term president, it's highly likely that he'll be able to appoint three more justices in the next.
In addition to the one
in
here.
In addition to this one.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been pretty vocal this week that she doesn't want to retire while Trump's in office because she knows she'll be replaced with a constitutional originalist. And although if he's a two-term president,
she wouldn't have much
choice. She may not have much choice. And then Anthony Kennedy is another one who, not necessarily a hard progressive, but he kind of flip flops. So he'll probably likely retire in the next few years. And then probably the third one that would retire would most likely be one of the conservative judges. So that would be another replacement type thing. But so that'll be really the big thing to see what direction the court's going to go into over the next several years.
Well, on the trumpet.com this week, you had an article, Will Justice Neil Gorsuch Make a Difference? It's an interesting point that you make in here, and that is that you see this trend in lawlessness happening in society generally, that even if the composition of the court were to turn more conservative, that there is a strong movement within society to reject the rule of law and to do what they want to do. You draw attention to the rise of the sanctuary cities, and Donald Trump has talked about trying to confront that trend in society. But it's like we're watching this inevitable clash between these two forces: one that is more for the rule of law, and one that's more for this lawless progressivism. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens with that. And this nomination to the Supreme Court of Mr. Gorsuch kind of puts that whole discussion front and center in the public eye. Definitely need to keep our eyes on it. Thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk quite a bit more about how the world is reacting to Donald Trump and how Donald Trump is reacting to the world, including Iran's effort to test the new American president, the White House making some nasty but basically true accusations against Germany, and the hysteria happening in American cities over President Trump's effort to enforce immigration law. We also have a story of an alarming kidnapping on the streets of Hong Kong. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This past Sunday, Iran launched a medium-range ballistic missile. And the very next day, Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen drove a boat filled with explosives into a Saudi frigate in the Red Sea. And there were some reports that indicated they thought it was a U.S. ship. Pretty provocative actions from Iran. And they seemed pretty directly aimed at challenging the United States and the new administration in the White House. How did the Trump administration respond? For this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So it took them a day or two to give a stronger response to Iran for both of these actions. But on Wednesday, that statement came, and it was delivered by the new national security advisor, Mr. Mike Flynn. And he talked about both of these acts, which I thought was very interesting. It's something that I didn't really bring out on the article necessarily, but the fact that they linked Iran's ballistic missile program, which is breaking previous United Nations Security Council resolutions that they shouldn't be able to test ballistic missiles that are capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. They were not allowed to do this for another 7 years, according to the nuclear deal. Iran would say that, well, we're allowed to do this because we don't have nuclear material. We don't have a nuclear bomb, right? So then we should be allowed to do this because it's not carrying nuclear. It can't carry anyway. We won't go into their reasoning. But along with condemning that action directly inside, you know, the same statement, the same 300-word statement, was a condemnation of Iran's backing of the Houthi inside Yemen. And the Obama administration really did do as much as it could not to play up Iran's role in supporting the Houthi inside Yemen. And yet, according to Mr. Trump, he sees them as direct Iranian proxies, that if Iran wanted to stop these militias or these terrorists in Yemen, they could. And he links them both and says, you better stop that. Right at the end of this statement, Mr. Flynn said this. He talks about the nuclear deal and the fact that Iran wasn't thankful for that. He said, instead of being thankful to the United States for these agreements, Iran is now feeling emboldened. As of today, we are officially putting Iran on notice. We haven't seen words like this for 8 years to Iran from the Obama administration.
On notice. What does that mean?
On notice. It's a really good question, and it is something that he is going to have to back up with some actions. Already today, we saw Mr. Trump come out with a new tweet against Iran, and he said, this was this morning, he said, Iran is playing with fire. They don't appreciate how, in quote, kind President Obama was to them, not me. So he's saying, I'm not going to be kind to you. You're playing with fire, and I'm the fire right now because you don't know what I'm going to do. And it looks like he might be proposing some type of sanctions on a few Iranian individuals and Iranian companies. So he might look to do that first. And then, you know, we'll see. I mean, what everyone's waiting for is, what if that was? Well, the question is, what if that was an American frigate? What if it wasn't the Saudis? Would the president order the Americans to shoot down that boat as it's heading towards them? Would it, if there's more provocative acts inside the Persian Gulf, which have increased, you know, twice as much in 2016 against America's fleet there, what would Mr. Trump do? We don't really know just yet.
Well, the question isn't going to be unanswered for very much longer, because you can be sure that Iran is not going to back down because of a tweet.
Right, right. They won't back down until they're forced to stop. And that's what most nations such as Iran would do. Until you're going to put skin in the game, we're going to keep pushing you. And that's what they've done for the past 8 years. Push, push, push. No reciprocation there. So they'll keep on acting. And really, I think this ballistic missile test was a test for Mr. Trump. The Iranians wanted to see what he would do. How much can we get away with this president? And I think there's a number of things that President Trump could do to show Iran that he means business. And I don't think sanctions will have the – while they are – while they will show the American public that Trump is willing to counter Iran and say, yes, I'm doing something about it. And I think Americans are calling for that because it was a promise that he gave at the election. I don't think it's going to have a big effect, because the whole reason the previous round of sanctions were effective on Iran that brought them to the negotiating table was because the whole world was on board. The whole world was on board. If Trump is going to want these sanctions to have effect, any type of financial sanctions, he's going to have to rope in Russia. He's going to have to rope in China. He's going to have to rope in Europe.
And yeah, that horse is out of the barn already. I mean, the sanctions are against Iran. The chances of bringing those back onto the table is very, very slim. It isn't going to happen. So the question then remains, what options really does a Trump White House have in a situation like this? And to me, this really kind of highlights the fundamental paradox here, that on one hand you have Donald Trump making these kinds of statements that really sound like tough guy talk, and yet on the other hand he's said that we need to withdraw from fulfilling obligations in the rest of the world, and we can't be the policeman for the Middle East and that type of thing. And so he's, you know, what does you're on notice mean? What does you're playing with fire mean? Apart from some kind of a military action, which he has indicated he's had enough of in a lot of areas.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This is the conundrum that I think he's put himself in, just because we know that America has needed to flex its military muscle to actually get a response from these nations or to change other nations' actions. I think that he is going to try and hold both promises in still not outsourcing America's military might to the world. And I think he's going to be a deal maker with other countries, trying to outsource his desires and countering Iran and using other nations to do so. I write in this piece on thetrumpet.com about it, that he's got some options in Syria that he could pursue to try and weaken Iran's hold there. But all of those options involve getting closer to other dictatorial powers.
Right.
And letting them do the dirty work on Iran, which I think that Trump would be more willing to do than put American troops in harm's way.
To this point, though, we haven't seen a great deal of effort on his part to reach out to other nations. It seems like this America First policy that seems to be alienating a lot of people around the world kind of runs counter to this idea that he's somehow going to be able to work all of these deals with these countries in order to get them on board with some multinational agreement against Iran and so on. You can't be the rogue and the cooperator at the same time, can you?
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult for him. He thinks that he has the cards. He has enough cards to play to hang over the head of other powers to help them submit to his will and help them sign agreements. Yes, America has got the great, and those cards are money. America has the largest economy in the world, imports more than anybody else in the world, and he's banking on the fact that other nations want that business, and he's going to put that business to them and say, you help me out here or else those economic benefits are going to go by the wayside. I believe that's what he thinks he's going to do. But that relies on also the fact that other nations agree with you and they want to support the United States. The United States isn't the favorite nation around the world by these other nations. He's upsetting Europe. he thought he was going to be close to Russia. It hasn't really turned out that way, at least in the beginning. So will the other nations of the world want to go hand in hand, looking like Trump's little poodle lapdog that does what he wants? I don't think they'll be so quick to do that.
Very interesting stuff. Thank you for that, Brent. As we talked about on Wednesday's program, leaders in Europe are strongly reacting to President Trump's apparent dislike of the European Union. Well, this past week, the Trump administration took another shot at Germany when the head of Mr. Trump's newly created National Trade Council, Peter Navarro, criticized Germany. He said, Germany continues to exploit other countries in the European Union, as well as the U.S., with an implicit Deutschmark that is grossly undervalued. Talking about the euro. So to learn more about this and Germany's response to this, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this really ties in with the story we've been tracking for several weeks now of just how Germany is starting to see the United States as their enemy. We brought this up ourselves a few weeks ago when talking about this, because everything that the Trump administration has said there is exactly true. The euro, it does just that. It gives Germany a built-in advantage, especially within Europe, but also overseas. And Germany's benefited a lot from that. But of course, they don't like people pointing that out. And so you've just seen, especially with this kind of enmity within Europe now continue to build. Donald Tusk, one of the three or four EU presidents, he talked about Europe's threats, and he basically outlined three threats to Europe: Russia and Russia's aggression, the rise, Islamism in the Middle East and the instability there, and Donald Trump's America. Kind of putting America now on an enemy of Europe on kind of the same level as Russia. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned that Joschka Fischer quote earlier about, the house is burning down, we need to make some big changes. So we're starting to see this, just more and more signs of this enmity really growing, and this divergence between Europe and the United States.
So when some people are looking at these comments from the Trump administration as a possible first shot being fired that could precipitate a trade war between the United States and Europe. How justified are those fears?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, Europe and China have already fired the first shots in the trade war, and America's just kind of done nothing about it. I think in one way of looking at it, you know, Germany is basically de facto subsidizing its products just as clearly as Russia was doing. I mean, as China has been doing with their devalued yuan a while ago. So, you could definitely see this escalating. But in a way, Europe has just been taking advantage of America. I mean, a lot of just Donald Trump's approach on that is correct. I think where you can really see Europe now and Germany starting to take advantage is the way that it's kind of Europe is rallying around itself and unifying, and Germany, I think, is really using now Donald Trump starting to fight back on these economic policies as an opportunity to rally Europe, to unite Europe, to make some of those changes that it's been pushing for, to lead that European military that really strong push began for last summer. EU leaders are meeting today in Malta. It'll be very interesting to see what conclusions they've come to, but all the talk about an EU military has just stepped up yet another notch since Donald Trump began its presidency. So you can see how there's a lot of opportunity for Germany in this antagonism that's building as well.
And one other prophetic trend that we have talked quite a bit about is the possibility of a mart of nations emerging between Europe and Asia. I just wonder, Richard, how much does this enmity that you're describing between America and Germany and Europe generally accelerate and increase the likelihood of that mart between Europe and Asia developing?
Yeah, I think it's just amazing the rapid progress we've seen towards this just in the last couple of weeks. Spiegel had an article talking about how German economy feels under threat. And really, you know, Germany has focused so much on building their economy in the post-war world. If you want to get Germany riled up, attacking or threatening the economy is kind of the way to do it. But they talked about this article. It says improved China ties with China would hold even greater promise. A new Berlin-Beijing alliance could, in part, at least supplant the old transatlantic order.
Now, this is Spiegel talking.
Yes, just this week. And yeah, Europe, one of Europe's most influential news magazines. I also saw, actually, it's just on its way up on the headlines section on our website, that new section, where Mexico is starting to look and say, well, we could have trouble trading with the United States. We need to form stronger ties with the European Union, and we need to form stronger ties with China. So you can really see the whole way of world trade shifting towards these two powers now,
and in an anti-American alliance. I mean, like if you have Mexico explicitly saying, well, we need alternatives to America, and we've talked about just how much the alignment of these nations is going to actually be used as some kind of embargo against the United States, you could see that developing.
Yes, and it's just developing so fast. There's been so much. You know, we did highlight the economic relationship between Germany and China before then, but just to have that go from kind of this growing trade relationship to this is an alternative to the transatlantic world order just in a couple of weeks, that's that's a quick change that we're just seeing already in Donald Trump's presidency.
Well, we appreciate that, Richard. We're going to turn our attention to a little bit of a domestic issue in the United States now. If you want to know the important news of the week, you really can't do better than to become a subscriber to the Trumpet Weekly. This is the report that we produce every week. The Trumpet staff puts together all the best news that we can from this previous week. The cover story on this week's edition, hysterical reaction to immigration order further divides two Americas. We talked in the first segment about how these two opposing forces you see in America between the rule of law on one hand and lawlessness on the other. We really saw that on display this past week. For this story, we're going to go back to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, as some of our listeners may have heard, Donald Trump has signed quite a few executive orders over the past couple weeks. Yeah. One of the more high notable ones was last Friday, where he had banned immigration for 120 days, about 4 months, from seven countries, Muslim-majority countries, to give the government
a... Muslim-majority countries that had a particular... That were security problems for terrorist
reasons.
That had
wars going inside them, basically.
Right. Right. So it wasn't a religious-based order. It was a security order.
Right. You can still immigrate from Saudi Arabia or Jordan or, I think, Turkey or many other Muslim-majority countries. But seven countries across North Africa and the Middle East that have a history of some domestic turmoil and other problems, jihadi problems. For 120 days, he said, I'm banning all immigration from these countries until the government has a chance to review our vetting strategies for new immigrants and new refugees. Mm-hmm. And you just had, like the headline says, a hysterical response to this. You have tens of thousands of demonstrators in 30 major cities. There were airports, at least two different airports shut down in California as people blocked terminals. They had police out there rerouting traffic as people blocked roads, several arrests. The media has gone, is probably the most responsible one for stirring up these tens of thousands of protesters with all these headlines, which, and this isn't hyperbole, but literally comparing this to Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. and what they'd done to the Jews and the Kristallnacht the strangest thing about this is this isn't even something that's new. These are basically I think what they've called a return to normalcy, where these are President Obama himself recently closed down the wet foot dry foot program, where we're no longer accepting refugees from communist Cuba, and earlier in his presidency had shut down all refugees from Iraq while the Iraq war was going on for a period of 6 months. President Bush had made similar laws. President Bill Clinton made similar laws. The elder Bush made similar laws. Actually, I believe the last six presidents have pretty much done the exact same thing at different parts of their presidency. Mm-hmm. Without the Kristallnacht level of just outrage. And it just does really highlight where I think Victor David Hansen had a piece at the National Review this week talking about, in a lot of parts, that Trump's agenda is almost identical to Bill Clinton's. And you can look up speeches by Bill Clinton about, we're a nation of laws, we can't allow illegal immigration into our country. And so you'd think that this is going as far right from the media outright, that Trump's trying to bring this nation back to 1930s level Germany with some of these decisions. Where it said, actually, no, he's actually pretty much just returning America to the center left Bill Clinton area policies. And so this hysterical outrage is more of a sign of just how much America changed in the 8 years under Obama, to where... at the time, I mean, Bill Clinton was considered quite a liberal president during his presidencies. But after 8 years of Obama, even going back to some of those same policies that we saw under George W. Bush or William Clinton, is just provoking. This level of outrage to where, you're literally seeing riots starting to break out in some of these. Cities, maybe not over this particular issue. This was more just blocking traffic and blocking airports. But with some of the Not My President riots right after the election, you definitely did see fires and stuff even being set to just show that the nation's at a level of division where they're almost willing to resort to violence to stop a president from returning America to the liberal policies of the Clinton era.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Stephen Fleury talked about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. He gave the majority of a program earlier in the week about this. I would really encourage everybody to certainly get the Trumpet Weekly or go on thetrumpet.com and read the article, Hysterical Reaction to Immigration Order. Listen to Stephen Fleury's program if you have the opportunity. Just a lot there to try to process. And this is, as you mentioned, Andrew, a trend that we've been watching for quite a long time, this embracing of lawlessness happening in the United States. And here you see it happening on a scale and over an issue that is probably worse than we have ever seen before. And I would expect that as the days and weeks click off of the Trump administration, you're going to see more of this type of division and hostility increasing within the United States populace. We appreciate you bringing that story to us. We're going to finish with a really alarming story out of Hong Kong. Hong Kong was under British control until 1997 when it was turned over to China on the condition that it would have, quote, a high degree of autonomy for a period of 50 years. Well, we're just 20 years into that 50-year agreement, and something happened this past week that really has shaken the sense that China is going to play by the rules that it agreed to. A lot of people fear that Hong Kong is losing its autonomy to China. This news confirmed those fears. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, when that handover took place from the UK to China, the Chinese signed all kinds of agreements saying that Hong Kong would have a high degree of autonomy for those 50 years. And China specifically promised not to meddle in Hong Kong's free press, its judicial system, and its bureaucracy. And then there was one cardinal rule of this 50-year agreement, which basically said no law enforcement agencies from mainland China would be allowed to carry out any kind of operation in Hong Kong for those 50 years. But last week, one of Hong Kong's most powerful and well-connected billionaires was abducted from his residence in Hong Kong by security agents from mainland China. So, like you said, here we are just 20 years into those 50, and this is just the most flagrant violation of that cardinal rule of autonomy that you could imagine. The billionaire, his name is Xiao Zhenhua. He's one of the wealthiest people in the world, actually, worth billions of dollars, and he's a citizen of both Canada and China. He also holds an Antiguan passport. He's extremely well-connected to the Communist Party there in the mainland. He's done all kinds of business deals with people in the highest echelons of the Chinese elite. He even bought a company not long ago from the sister of Chinese President Xi Jinping. So this guy is just very powerful. He surrounds himself with an elite team of bodyguards, but none of that power, none of those security measures were enough to deter the Chinese agents from illegally barging in and abducting him. And no one's heard from this guy for about a week now. Some onlookers speculate that Mr. Xiao's abduction is intended as kind of a warning to a political group in Hong Kong that he had dealings with. Others believe that he may have known some sensitive information about some of those high-ranking Chinese leaders. But in either case, it's very likely that the Communist Party will take his vast holdings in various financial institutions and nationalize them. That's the big concern here. In any case, I wouldn't really vouch for this man's innocence necessarily. There's a lot of details about this case that nobody knows yet. But the abduction was just a clear and stark violation of Hong Kong's autonomy. And it's just one more very sobering indication of Chinese President Xi Jinping's just utter disregard for that promised autonomy.
Very interesting. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com, and we'll give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news. That is coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this past week, and we'll start with Brent.
On Tuesday, the Palestinian Authority put forward a new date to hold its long overdue municipal elections. The elections are now set for May 13, 2017, this year, about six months after the original date. The original postponement was likely due to a miscalculation on the part of Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas, who assumed that the rival Hamas wouldn't participate. But Hamas said they would participate, and therefore Abbas did cancel those elections. So it's probably likely now that Abbas feels that Fattah's position is more secure than it was last year, which is why he felt comfortable announcing the forthcoming elections. Nevertheless, there is still a danger that events between now and May 13 could propel Hamas back into favor inside the West Bank, which is something the Trumpet is watching for.
And now, Andrew.
Rex Tillerson was sworn in as U.S. Secretary of State on Wednesday. Mr. Tillerson's the former secretary of ExxonMobil and Trump's pick for someone with a clear-eyed focus on foreign affairs. He had fought a fairly controversial Senate confirmation process due to over some of his ties to Russia, but was eventually able to get enough votes to be affirmed this week.
All right, we'll go now to Richard.
Pope Francis vanquishes the Knights of Malta is the headline of an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly. There's no way I can summarize it all in just 30 seconds, but it's about the just a lot of a power play within the Catholic Church and the Pope grabbing much more power for himself, for the papacy, and clearing the way to allow unity with other Christian groups. So if you want to know more details, look that up, but some significant changes within the Catholic Church.
All right. Good effort there, Richard. We'll go now to Jeremiah.
Mr. Rodrigo Duterte, he's the president there in the Philippines, and he said on Thursday that he would start to use the armed forces of the Philippines as the main force in his anti-drug war. Up until now, it's been the police and various vigilante groups that have been tasked with killing drug traffickers and users in the country. But Duterte says the police are too corrupt to do it right, so he's bringing in the big guns. And so the military will now take the leading role in this crusade.
All right, back to Brent.
In order to send a return message to Donald Trump, some 220 members of the 290 that make up the Iranian parliament signed a statement this week expressing their, quote, full-fledged support for the country's military. According to the Iranian-run Press TV, they said, quote, the sole way to ward off any aggression against Iran is to boost the country's missile might. That's what the MPs added along with their statement. In a meeting with the Armenian defense minister, Iran's Supreme National Security Council secretary said this, quote, we will not ask for permission from any country or international organization to expand our conventional defense capabilities.
And we'll finish with Andrew.
Thousands of leftist protesters hurled smoke bombs, broke windows, and sparked a massive bonfire Wednesday night at the University of California campus at Berkeley. The grievance that started the riot was the presence of a Breitbart news editor who wanted to give a lecture at Berkeley College.
Horror of horrors. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com. We'll give you a free subscription to the Trumpet Weekly. Absolutely no charge. And it has everything that we talked about on the program today and a whole lot more on top of that. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Gerald Fleury. Never take your eyes off God. He is famous for last-minute heroics. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.